Joining me here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Maria Crezon. She is a co-author of the book Cycle of Segregation, a professor of sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you for inviting me.
You do a very deep dive into this subject because I think there's pre-established notions that people have of why segregation occurs. And the deep dive, I think, is necessary because it kind of goes to some of these underlying reasons. But the issue most people think, well, people just want to be with their own kind of thing.
Right, yeah. I mean, you sort of refer to people have these preconceived notions, and the truth is the scholars and researchers and policymakers have also had these same sort of set of three explanations for segregation that just sort of permeate both the popular discourse, but also policymakers
and
the researchers. That's right. So the three, to break the excitement over what those three might be, the three are, like you referred to, one of them is sort of preferences. People think, well, birds of a feather flock together. People just want to live with their quote own kind. So that's one of the core explanations that we've looked at. There's also the explanation of money. Money matters, right? So continues to be racial inequality in income and wealth in this country. And so people just live where they can afford to live, and that translates, because there's inequality in income, that translates into people living in different neighborhoods. And the third one is that discrimination happens, that despite the fact, and actually April 2018 is a momentous month in the area of fair housing. 50 years ago this month, the Fair Housing Act was passed, which made it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race and ethnicity in renting and buying housing. Well, it turns out, we've made progress. Some of the most blatant forms of discrimination have disappeared, but there's still persistent discrimination, lots of evidence that there still are people get treated differently when they try to rent a house or buy a house. So those are the big three we talk about.
But now when you take the deeper dive, it becomes almost that it's just inculcated in our lifestyles.
Right. All of this we've sort of in this country, to go back a ways, we've really baked segregation into the cities in our country, Chicago being a great example of that. We've created a system that's segregated, and we have to ask ourselves, why does it keep being segregated, even in the face of the expansion of the black middle class, softening white racial attitudes, and reductions in discrimination? And what the sort of shift in your framework is, how do people end up living where they end up living, right? What is the process people go through in order to make a move? And what is it about those processes that ends up funneling us into segregated neighborhoods? And that's really the point of our book. We're sort of saying, let's change the conversation, let's expand the conversation, right? The big three still matter, but let's shift and ask, how do you end up living where you end up living? What shapes the information that you draw, and what shapes the process that you go through when you're making a search? And we talk about the social factors that shape that. So if you just think yourself about the last time you made a move, what did you do, right? You probably asked your friends and family, well, what's a good place to live? Where should I go? Right? So those social networks inform your search process in lots of direct and indirect ways. And I can
go ahead.
Elaborate on that. So the direct way might be, oh, yeah, so I was just driving down the street and I saw a house for sale down the street from my house. Maybe you want to buy that house, right? So there's a very direct impact of social networks. There's also another direct impact of social networks that I want to live by my friends and family, want to see them, right? I mean, there are some people who don't want to live by their friends and family, but that also creates a sort of consideration set of neighborhoods for people. But there's also indirect ways that social networks matter, even when you're not looking for a place to live, right? As we live our lives and as we interact with people, we're gathering information about our metro area, about the Chicago area. We're learning about, just a chance comment at the over the water cooler at work. Somebody says, oh, yeah, I was just out in, pick a name of a city, with my kids, and it looks really nice out there, right? We're gathering information all the time. It's the stuff of living in a city about places, and we're learning what places are the good places, what are the bad places. Or I know that my boss grew up in a particular city, and I know my boss is white and middle class and Catholic, so it's probably a community that's white, middle class, and Catholic, right? So we're always making these inferences about communities based on our social networks and our exposure to different people. So where segregation comes in, then, is that we know that those social networks are racially segregated, often, on average. People tend to have social networks that are comprised of, especially white people, of individuals who are white. African Americans' social networks tend to have more African Americans than other groups, right? Same with Latinos. So if that information that's coming to you is racially circumscribed, then the moves that come out of that information process are sort of, you're funneled in a direction that is going to perpetuate segregation.
So it's almost like we're each in our own silo, kind of, that silo builds walls.
Right. Builds walls, and it funnels us into making moves because the information that we're gathering and the perceptions that we're gathering are racialized. We end up making moves, and those moves in the aggregate across a city, right, thousands of people moving every year, just continues to perpetuate. That's where the perpetuation comes from. Because we're segregated residentially, right, that's one factor of why we have segregated social networks. So those segregated social networks are feeding information about where my next move is, which make
a reinforcement.
Reinforcement, exactly.
We're speaking with Maria Crazen. She is professor of sociology at University of Illinois Chicago, and she's co-author of the book Cycle of Segregation. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue. Joining me here in the studio is Maria Crazen. She's professor of sociology at the University of Illinois Chicago and co-author of the book Cycle of Segregation, which examines everyday social processes that shape residential stratification that really is the segregation here. So we talk about how we have, you know, we have our same social networks of like-minded people that serve as a reinforcement technique, but that still keeps everything segregated. How do we end the cycle of segregation?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. I wish I knew the one answer that we could just snap our fingers and have it taken care of, but obviously that's not the case. But I think the idea of our, part of the argument in our book is that instead of focusing on these big three explanations of economics, preferences, and discrimination, again, we have to work on those three, and we certainly have to continue to enforce the Fair Housing Act and discrimination. But we want to, by focusing on how people search for places to live, that really opens up some policy levers that were kind of not on our radar screens prior to this. And it says, how do we intervene in this search process? A search process that's informed by social networks and that's informed by lived experiences. How do we intervene to provide, for example, information and to reshape people's perceptions about communities that have been, prior to this, really shaped by these sort of racially circumscribed experiences? So how do you, for example, if we understand that one of the things that's going on is that people have racial blind spots, people know more about communities that are segregated, comprised of their racial group, how do you have public PR campaigns? You know, communities could have campaigns and PR campaigns to reach out to individuals who are, you know, not the sort of person they expect to come and try to move into their community.
You mean a diversity outreach kind of program?
Right, or just even creating you know, imagery that is racially diverse, that says all people are welcome here, right? So one of the things that we didn't talk about much is that people's perceptions, they use shortcuts. They don't do detailed research like, you know, get online.
Your deep dive.
Find everything there is to know about communities. People don't know everything, and they use shortcuts. We call them heuristics, right? They're shortcuts. I know one thing about a place, and I can fill in the blank on all the other characteristics. So for many white people in particular, if I know one thing about a community, if I know that it's got a high percentage of African Americans, they often will fill in the blank and say it's also must be bad schools, high crime, property values won't increase, right? For African Americans, they may know...
Uninformed,
exactly. And so how do we intervene? We can create information campaigns and easy to access information about communities to try to disrupt that process of the heuristic, right? Interrupt the assumptions that people make about communities.
But as you said, this is, in a way, it is intervening in that process. And so
That's, I mean, it's not an aggressive intervention.
No, right? Understood.
It's,
right.
So it's not, nobody's telling anybody where to move, but it's, you know, basically we're saying we have constructed this situation and we need to break down some of these perceptions, both in reality and in just the perception.
But it would seem to me difficult to do that because that's not going to be a natural tendency of
right.
people.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It has to be intentional. I mean, like I have said, you know, it took us decades and decades of intentional actions. We haven't talked about this yet. The reason we have segregation is not some unknowable thing, and it's not some accident. It's not natural, right? There are lots of actors at the state, the federal, and the local level that have created segregation. There's Richard Rothstein's book, The Color of Law, put a pitch out there for that, really lays out the case that this was intentional. We created segregation intentionally. So we have to be just as intentional to undo this segregation. We have to have programs. We have to commit to undoing this because we got ourselves into this through very intentional actions at all levels of government. All levels of government need to be intentional.
Government helped build the walls. Government helped.
Absolutely, I mean, helped build.
Look at how the interstate highway system
correct.
Was used to basically segregate
yes,
communities.
Yes, and mortgage lending, redlining, you know, the list goes on. Public housing sites and segregated public housing, it just, the disinvestment in communities once you created the highways to get people out of the city. Yeah, there's just, I mean, it's just decades and decades of action. So we need to start having that same intentionality about undoing some of this.
And you're saying it should be government that, I mean.
Well, I think that's the thing about our book is that we really highlight how at many different levels. I mean, it's at the individual level. You ask yourself, if you care about this issue, how am I going to do my next housing search, right? But it can go up to communities that care about this and care about more equity and more integration that decide we're going to do something about this. We're going to reach out to communities that normally don't come to our doorsteps.
Do you think communities care about
I think
that?
There are communities that care, and I think there are people that care.
There are some.
Mm-hmm.
But is this something that's necessary?
Right. I mean, I think there's carrots and sticks. I mean, I think that, yeah, some communities can be, well, not to get too far in the weeds of policy, but the end of the Obama administration, they passed new rules about the Fair Housing Act that had been not as aggressively pursued, and but mostly the Fair Housing Act has been about enforcing anti-discrimination, right? But there's something called affirmatively furthering fair housing, which is also part of the Fair Housing Act.
That's the proactive.
That's the more proactive, right? So there are new rules for communities that were guidelines to communities really thinking about what are the barriers to integration in my community and how can we undo these. And we think that our book offers some ideas about this for communities. Now, the Trump administration has paused the implementation of those rules. But I think this is something that communities around the country and cities recognize, that segregation is a problem for all of us. It's costing all of us, and we need to figure out ways. So, yes, the government is involved, but, you know, individuals, local governments can be involved, neighborhood groups can be involved. You can go up and down the...
And you don't necessarily need the rules.
The
proactive rules that these groups, communities, whatever, can act on their own.
They can act on their own. I mean, I think the rules, I think they need to implement the rules, but I also think that there are openings, and there are communities around the country that are pursuing it nevertheless.
Now, you have an event coming up on Wednesday, Disrupting the Cycle of Segregation, at John Marshall Law School. I believe that's from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. And do you know where they can get more information about this event? Actually, I know it's on Eventbrite. You can get tickets are free there. And if you just search for
Disrupting the Cycle of Segregation, yep.
And you'll be there with your
my co-author Kyle Crowder from the University of Washington, yep.
And also, where can they get the book? I think it's on Amazon.
It is on Amazon. You can go to the publisher, Russell Sage Foundation, and maybe some local bookstores.
And just and again, search for Cycle of Segregation.
Yes.
Maria Creason, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's a deep dive, but it's one that makes you think in ways that you're not used to thinking. And I think that's always an important thing for all of us to
yes,
learn how new ways of thinking and new ideas. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.